It seems odd to imagine Jesus wearing large sunglasses and a baseball cap with his jacket collars pulled up to hide his face and his jawline a little bit, kind of like a celebrity that you see those photos of celebrities when they're traveling around on the street trying not to be noticed. But this is exactly how Mark 7 presents him in the second half of the events recorded there. Jesus was traveling out of his home from the region of Capernaum or Galilee, the north region of Israel, and he was traveling up farther north into Gentile, foreign territory. It's a region known as Tyre. He was staying in someone's house there, and he thought he could avoid being recognized by staying there. You may remember the name of that place, Tyre, from earlier in our study in Mark's gospel. Just before this event, remember Jesus performed the miracle of feeding 5,000 men with the loaves and the fishes. And I mentioned when we read that passage that many of the Israelites in Galilee, there where that miracle was performed, many of them had probably never seen so much food in their lives, because even though there were farms in that region, most of the produce was shipped north and consumed by the wealthy Gentile region known as Tyre. The ancient Jewish historian, who was a contemporary of Jesus, named Josephus, famously calls the people of Tyre our most bitter enemies. There was no love loss between the people, and especially in the north there, the Galileans, and those who lived in Tyre. Militarily, they were hostile toward one another, so in times of war, they were at odds, and they were right there, sharing the border. Commercially, as we've already seen, they were right there across the border, but they were the commercial center in Tyre. There was a coastline there, and so they were the central Roman trading port in the area, and they consumed most of the wealth and resources and food in the region. Historically, the Israelites remembered Tyre as the birthplace of someone famous, or maybe I should say infamous. Tyre was the birthplace of a lady you may remember by the name of Jezebel. That's not a good look. That's not a good memory in Israel. But that's what they remembered Tyre for. Religiously, they were pagan, thoroughly pagan. There were idols and temples. And culturally, they were a Gentile region. They were known for being Hellenistic. That's just kind of the classical way of referring to Greek. They were very Greek in their culture, in their ways of living. They were completely unclean. Completely, from a Pharisaical point of view, completely unclean, as we've been seeing that Pharisaical view presented and critiqued in Mark 7. Well, this is where Jesus is staying, traveling and staying, hoping to remain anonymous. But Mark says that lovely phrase, verse 24, Jesus cannot remain hidden. A wonderful phrase, so much packed into that. He's trying to stay hidden, though, but a woman whose daughter was tormented by an unclean spirit somehow found him. Not just found the city where he was, but found the very house where he was staying, trying to remain hidden. And she somehow made her way into the house and fell at his feet and begged and continued to beg, it says, for her daughter's deliverance. If you're just coming to this passage for the first time, you may ask very good questions. How did this woman find Jesus? How did she even know who Jesus was in the first place? Mark doesn't tell us any of these details. In chapter 5, if we back up, Jesus cast a legion, thousands of demons, out of a Gerasene demoniac, and then he told that man to go home and tell everyone what happened. There's also an episode earlier in Mark's gospel. Jesus has cast out an unclean spirit from a man in his hometown synagogue in Capernaum. You might remember that from earlier on. And Capernaum is just to the south of Tyre. So somehow word of one of these events has reached up and permeated this area, and this woman in Tyre has heard about it. And somehow, even in the days before photos, remember, just think about, with no photos, somehow she knew how to track down Jesus and knew how to recognize him. And there she is on the ground at Jesus' feet, begging and begging for him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Mark describes this woman as a Greek woman. That's a very important detail. She was born in Syrophoenicia. In other words, for the purposes of Mark's gospel, she was totally a Gentile. She was totally an outsider, unclean, with all the background associations of Jezebel and paganism and the associations of her people being the political and cultural enemies of Israel. Now, if you've never studied this passage before, the conversation that they have may strike you as odd. I mean, good grief, if you have studied this passage before, it also may strike you as odd. Jesus' response, especially to this woman at his feet, he says, first, the children must be fed. It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. Just like last week, Jesus is not saying what we expect him to say. What is going on here? Well, to understand this curious passage, we have to imagine what life would be like before the invention of something we all take for granted. And that is the great invention known as the napkin. The napkin. I told you, you take it for granted. You didn't think I was going to say the napkin. But imagine what life would be like before the napkin, at a time in history before paper was cheap to produce, or even fabric was cheap to produce. Both of these things were very expensive to produce or come by in Jesus' day. Napkins, as we think of them, had not been invented yet and were not available or used. Neither had cheap silverware, by the way. So most people ate with their hands, as a custom that, if you've ever traveled widely, you know still is common in certain places of the world. And when they ate with their hands in place of napkins, they used a combination of bread and little dogs. Listen to how historian Margaret Visser explains. At the end of dinner, it was an ancient practice to wipe one's hands on bread, which one then threw to the dogs. From time immemorial, dogs have accompanied humankind at dinner. They are faithfully depicted on ancient Greek vase paintings of dinner parties and in paintings of peoples at banquets in every age. The Greeks kept especially fine, quote, table dogs, which the host would show off to the guests, and perhaps guests brought their own animals to the party. When there were several dogs present, they were often tied to different couches to prevent them from fighting. The animals got not only, quote, the children's crumbs, as the New Testament puts it, but also the bones, gristle, and fish heads anyone threw down to them. This morning in Sunday school, some of the young people and I looked at a photo. There's an ancient pottery, a bowl from Corinth that you can see if you ever visit the Louvre in Paris. And on the side of this bowl, there are paintings of feasts. And there's plain as day, there's a painting on the side of this Corinthian bowl of a banquet in the Greek style. The diners are reclining. You remember, they never ate sitting on chairs. They would recline on these sort of elevated couches. And they're reclining on these couches up high next to these tables. And below them are, each table has a well-groomed dog tied to one of the furniture legs. And in several of the little paintings, they're eating scraps off the floor that have been thrown down to them. Some of you have canine family members, just like this Corinthian painting. And now you know, if your friends ever give you a hard time about them, you can say, don't worry, it's a Greek thing, my dog is classically trained. If your friends are like mine, that's not going to work very well. It certainly wouldn't have worked in Israel. Recall that in Israel, dogs were basically like furry pigs. They were gross animals, disgusting scavengers, and that was all. But remember, this woman is a Greek. She's from the city of Tyre, where little dogs were part of family meals, even fancy formal meals. Who knows? There could have been one such or several such little dogs tied to the table or couch legs right next to where this woman was, hugging Jesus' feet. But as different as the Hellenistic culture was, there was still a proper order. There was still an etiquette. It wasn't, of course, a free-for-all. In Tyre, just like Jesus described it, it would be wrong to show up to a dinner and serve the puppies first. The food was served to the people first. It was in a family meal. It was given to the children first. And then, once they were finished, they would throw their bread to the little dogs. There's one other important detail that helps us in the background here. It's important to keep in mind that Israel, especially Galilee, that was the very poor region for purposes of comparison. The people in Galilee were poor and needy and suffering. The people in Tyre were much more comfortable materially and physically prosperous. Scholars note that most likely this woman who came and found Jesus and fell at his feet and is begging for these things, she's probably wealthy from a prosperous city from this area. She's probably wealthy by comparison to Jesus and his own background and the Galileans where he spent so much time recently ministering. So by responding the way that he does, Jesus is embodying for us the epistle lesson that we heard in James 2. Jesus is not showing partiality. Jesus is, in fact, not giving any preferential treatment or even preferential positioning to this woman from a very wealthy, prosperous background. The Gospels portray Galilee as a kind of epicenter of hunger and an epicenter of disease. And as I mentioned a moment ago, Jesus can't even go to synagogue in his own hometown without encountering someone in synagogue with an unclean spirit. And he recalled his primary focus, his primary mission, was to alleviate the suffering of the children of Israel. God had made specific promises, and he had those to fulfill to the children of Israel. Even though, we're seeing in Mark's gospel, they were in the process of rejecting him, that he knew it. He knew this was happening. And even though his life might have been a lot more comfortable and cushy, if, and possibly quite a lot safer as well, if he relocated his ministry to Tyre, Jesus would not be put off his mission. Jesus was faithful. Jesus was persistent. Just like there is an etiquette, a proper order to a meal, so there is a proper order in the history of redemption. And the gospel must be preached to the Jew first, and then go out to the Greek. Jesus communicates this to the woman by using that word first. First, he says, first the children must eat. It would be wrong to give their bread to the dogs first. Jesus loves the little doggies as well as the little children. He's going to provide for them both, but first the little children. The truly amazing thing about this story, if we can get past the stepping on our toes and our sensibilities as modern readers, the truly amazing thing about this story is that basically for the first time, and I suspect maybe the only time in Mark's gospel, Jesus says something parabolic. He says something like a parable, and someone hears him and understands exactly what he's saying. We expect this woman to be Jezebel. She actually turns out to be an Abigail. I can't wait to get to heaven and talk to this woman. In English, we have a phrase. We say to people, I heard it said numerous times in numerous ways at the football game last night, get with the program. Get with the program. This woman was with the program. She got it entirely. She understood it perfectly. Somehow, she knew exactly what was going on and what Jesus meant about the history of redemption. just like Cornelius, the centurion. She seeks Jesus out from far away and finds him. And she understands exactly what he means as she clings to his feet. And she says those two most important words in all the Christian life, "Yes, Lord." And then she adds the third and says the three most important words of the Christian life, "Yes, Lord, yet." Yet, even the little dogs under the table get to eat the crumbs that fall. In other words, I'm not asking you to divert your entire mission to the children of Israel. I'm not asking you to change your priorities radically all of a sudden, to serve their bread to the little dogs right now. I know you need to follow the proper order. But all throughout the meal, the children drop crumbs on the floor. And when this happens, before the time comes for the bread to officially be thrown to the little dogs get to eat and clean up the crumbs. I know I'm asking a lot from you, yet, measured against who you are and your power, this is really just like a little crumb falling off the table. In the words of C.S. Lewis, on that beautiful scene where the girls are begging Aslan, he says finally, "Ah, you have conquered me." Or in the words of James 2, mercy triumphs over judgment. Or in Jesus' literal words here, verse 29, "Because you have said this, go your way. Your daughter is loosed from the evil spirit." And when the woman came to her house, she found her daughter reclining on a bed, and the demon was gone. You will remember that the original meaning of the name Israel, the original meaning of that name, the reason it was given, was because a man wrestled with God and prevailed somehow. "I will not let you go until you bless me," he had said. This Greek Syrophoenician woman possessed more of the spirit of Israel than many who bore the name around her. She persisted in prayer at the feet of Christ, and Christ was pleased with her tenacity, and he rewarded. Well, quickly, Mark takes us immediately from this scene to the second miracle in the region known as the Decapolis. Deca is 10. The Decapolis were the 10 cities on the far side of the Sea of Galilee. Originally, it was part of the promised land that had been promised to Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh. But all sorts of history took place, and by the time of Jesus' day, it was an odd hodgepodge of largely Gentile people, but still partly connected to Israel, similar to maybe Samaria, a region kind of like Samaria, a very mixed region. Here, some people brought Jesus a man who could not hear and was hindered in his speech. In English, we sometimes call someone hard of hearing. Literally, Mark calls this man deaf and hard of speaking. We heard our Old Testament reading, Isaiah 35, and if you're familiar with Handel's Messiah, maybe you heard those words sung as you heard them read this morning. Right in the middle of Handel's Messiah is this passage: "Then shall the eyes of the blind be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped." You know, they pronounce it that way in Messiah. "Then shall the lame man leap as the hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing." Kids, the word "dumb" here, you should note, is not an insult. It's not a bad word. We're not making fun of these people. The word "dumb" literally means in our language someone who can't speak or whose tongue has a hard time making words. In order to speak clearly, a person has to first hear clearly. There are many theories about this man and his condition. The one that I find persuasive is that he was born able to hear, but tragically, like so many, at some point early on in his life, maybe a fever or an infection, he lost his hearing. And so he was able to speak a little bit, but not very much. And it was hard to communicate with him. And at this point in his life, he had no hearing. His hearing was entirely gone. The people bring him to Jesus so that Jesus can lay his hands on the man. And they want to see what happens. But Jesus does something odd again. He takes the man away from everyone else. And by himself, with the man, he does all sorts of odd things. Perhaps he does this, I mean, I've got some experts here with us in signing. Perhaps he does this so that the man will understand a little bit better what's happening to him. He sticks his fingers into the man's ears. Kids, you can try all this at home later on, not in church, but you can try all this later on at home when you're reviewing this passage. He sticks his fingers in the man's ears, and then he spits and touches the man's tongue. And we covered this in Sunday school, and the kids said the exact same thing that my daughter said when we read this earlier in the week. Those exact two words. Ew! Gross! He spits, and he touches this man's tongue. But that man didn't say, ew, gross. But he did say something. In fact, he said a lot of things. Jesus looked up to heaven, and he sighed, or he groaned loudly and said to the man, be opened. And that Mark gives us that lovely Aramaic word, literally the exact word that Jesus spoke, ephatha. And immediately the man's ears were open, and it says his tongue was loosed, so that Mark says he could finally speak plainly. And the word plainly is the Greek word orthos, from which we derive our word orthodoxy. Straight words, true doctrines. Jesus here tells the man, don't tell anyone. Jesus knows all things. He knows what's going to happen. And you can probably guess what's going to happen, because the man has not been able to speak plainly for years and years and years, and now finally he can, and he disobeys Jesus. He tells everybody what happened. How could he not? He's talking plainly and hearing everybody, and they recognize him and say, wait, that's the deaf mute man. How are you? How can you hear me? How are you talking right now? The more that Jesus commands this, it seems, the more famous he becomes. Everyone was amazed. Everybody who knew this man and recognized him and had this encounter, and the man explained what happened. And they said, just like God at the end of Genesis 1, they said, all his works are good. They're very good. Look at what he's done. Here, Mark's given us the second of two enacted parables here. Both of them are mysterious. First, redemption must come to Israel. But the time is at hand when the children's mealtime is going to be over, and they are going to throw the bread to the little dogs. And when this happens, there are people and places far away where once upon a time men might have had the truth, men heard the word, but that was a long time ago. And somewhere along the line, they lost the truth and became as if deaf. They were confused and handicapped. They were full of error, and false religions came down through the ages. But the time would come now when their ears would be open. They would again be able to speak truly. Orthodoxy would be proclaimed in the nations and by the nations. They'd hear the word of the Lord clearly. They would hear it in a way they could understand. They would hear it in their own languages. They would be baptized, heaven would be opened, and down would come the Spirit upon them. We saw last week, all of these things happened with Cornelius, the Roman centurion, the uncircumcised, together with his household. And when it did, they praised God in tongues, confirming God's wonderful work among the Gentiles. All of these things were milestones. They were massively important events in the history of redemption, in the history of God's people, the church. And they are also very important lessons for us in our lives as Christians, as Christian people. We'll look at this in a moment at the table, but first, please pray with me. Our gracious Father in heaven, through your Son, you do all things well. Give us your heart, good order balanced with mercy, faith and perseverance, hearts free of partiality and full of living, active faith, ears open and eager to hear your word, and baptized tongues to speak your truth in love. In Jesus' name, amen.